For the week of March 25th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 405, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you doing, Michael?
Good. Sorry, I had no funny location for you to play off of, and you were at a loss for words, weren't you?
I was. I was a little bit. Yes. Normally, you're in, Wakanda.
Niger.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you this. You can start off by apologizing.
I'm sorry that I stole all of your Facebook data and used it for, to get myself elected to the school board of,
You should apologize for not having a show next week.
Yes, it is my fault. It is spring break and I will be in Fort Lauderdale, whooping it up with the college kids.
Really?
No, okay. That last part is not true, but it is spring break and I will be off traveling with my children.
Are you going to Disneyland or anything, or what's your destination?
Going to Seattle. So if you're in Seattle and want me to say hello, want to swing by and say hello, let me know.
You can enjoy the rain.
Yes. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
And you really should rate and review the show, because I know you haven't done it yet, because we've got tens of thousands of listeners and not even 100 reviews.
I know.
Shame
I
on
do
you.
Not
Come
get
on.
It.
We've tried pleading. We've tried jokes. Now we're going to go for the Jewish mother guilt.
that's very funny. Yeah. I mean, it's really true what they say, that like less than 1% of people comment on blog posts and rate and review podcasts. It's very, very true.
Yes. Well, but you're going to be traveling next week. We won't have a show, but you will be in the car with your kids. And you'll have a chance to catch up on your podcast, which means you'll be listening to the show. When you do, what will you be hearing about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, the box office may be slow this March, but we've got a lot of stories to cover. Marvel is conquering theme parks. The Chinese government sees film as propaganda. And MoviePass, yes, we're still covering them. They have lowered their prices again. Every year, Michael takes part in a film awards group called the IRAs, where they vote on the best movie of the year. He'll tell us who won this year, who lost, and why. Spoiler alert, my heart is racing. In the music industry, the news is good. Revenue has jumped by double digits for the second year in a row, but the Recording Industry Association of America cautions about optimism and says this recovery is still fragile. On Inside Baseball, we'll be joined by Travell Anderson of the Los Angeles Times to discuss the successful marketing campaign for the film Love, Simon and what it means for queer films in the future. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we start. But then we also pull information from Hollywood Reporter, Variety, the LA Times, the New York Times, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, and you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Pacific Rim Uprising, $150 million on its opening weekend. That's the reported budget of the film. So they're in good shape. A modest opening here in North America, though it did beat out Black Panther. It is now the number one film in North America, and doing a lot better overseas, just like the original did. We'll have to see where it ends up, but they should be all right.
Thank you, China.
Yes, exactly. We'll have to see if it holds, but it certainly had a solid opening.
Yeah, it opened up in 63 territories, probably because they knew that making a film, okay, this is a Warner Brothers film, making a film about a film that was a flop basically in America, but it made money in China, that they had to release it day and date.
So we have a story later about piracy. Piracy is still an issue.
Yes, indeed. They didn't want it opening in the U.S. and having it pirated overseas, especially in China.
It's actually a Universal film. It for some reason studios. I was just double checking on that. But yeah, for some reason it switched studios. I don't know why. I think the original was Warner Brothers.
I believe so. It was a Guillermo del Toro movie.
And it's very odd that it switched studios. You don't see that happen a lot, but it has. I think because maybe the main backer of the first one was an independent production company.
Legendary. That's right. You're right. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Explanation.
And
done.
By the way, I wouldn't be shocked, since Legendary is now partly owned Chinese and maybe majority owned Chinese. I think Wanda owns them. If it was in every single movie theater in China, like it was the only film you could see.
Well, number two around the world is another film you can be able to see. It's Tomb Raider. That grossed $45 million on the weekend. That's at $210 million worldwide. So that also looks like it's going to be okay commercially. I'm not sure they'll be excited enough to make a sequel, but they're off to an okay start. Number three is Peter Rabbit, another $30 million on the weekend. That's at $180 million worldwide. So we can put that firmly in the hit category. And that's certainly true for Black Panther. Was it a five-week run or six-week run at the top of the North American box office?
Five weeks.
That's a lot of time to be on top of the box office, even in February. It grossed $30 million this weekend. It's at $1,237 million worldwide. It's the highest grossing superhero film of all time in North America, and it's still got a ways to go. It'll probably be the third highest grossing movie in North American history. It's certainly way up there in the box office list of all-time movies worldwide, a huge success story. And number five, another big hit. I mean, we got a lot of good news here at the box office, don't we? I Can Only Imagine. This is the faith-based film that opened up very well last week and had a terrific hold. $13 million on the weekend, $38 million worldwide. It only cost $7 million to make, but it's far from done in North America.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Easter is coming, so it'll be another chance for church-based groups to go out and see a film. But there are three different faith-based movies all coming out one weekend after another. So
that's
back
right.
To
way
back
down
to
on
back.
The list is Paul, Apostle of Christ. That grossed $5 million, which is its budget. That's a film starring Jim Caviezel, not as Paul, but as St. Luke. Don't get that wrong. So that had an okay opening given its budget, and it too is looking forward to the holiday season. And it was Mary Magdalene had already opened up in North America, and I'm not sure what's coming up after that, but I think I Can Only Imagine has already planted its flag. People are going to go see this movie. They're going to go see it again. It's not going to fall off fast because audiences love it. And number six is Sherlock Gnomes, a sequel to another animated film about garden gnomes. God knows why we needed that, but it grossed $15 million on its opening weekend. And number seven is A Wrinkle in Time, $10 million on the weekend, $90 million worldwide, just shy of that. It's in 14 territories, but given the look and production design and the story of this film, I'm thinking it actually will play well in Asia. And I'm thinking maybe it won't. I don't know if it'll save its bacon, but it may keep this film from being a financial disaster. It sort of has that feel and that vibe that you see in a number of Asian films. I think it's sort of over-the-top production design and characters and the heroic journey of a small child. I think it may register in those countries. So maybe the story isn't done yet. It's only playing in 14 territories. So even though it cost $100 million to make, it's done very poorly in the U.S., the story's not over for A Wrinkle in Time. That's why we look at the worldwide box office.
Well,
and number eight is
I think
Red
the story
Sparrow.
Is over for Red Sparrow.
It's in 64 territories. It grossed $8 million on the weekend. It's at $120 million worldwide. It's surely not going to become a success story just at the box office alone. And as we can see from these grosses, if you wanted to get into the top 10, you had to gross about $7 million. So it did that worldwide, but it's falling pretty hard and pretty fast. That's not the case for Love, Simon. We'll be talking about this movie more in our Inside Baseball segment. It grossed another $7.8 million on the weekend. It's at $24 million worldwide. It's only playing in North America. But like I Can Only Imagine, had a very good hold. It dropped, I think, about 30%. Audiences loved it. It's going to be a success story. It's going to make money when all is said and done. And, you know, it's not really a modest bet. We get, you know, oh, $100 million, $200 million. We just ignore that. $17 million is a good amount of money for a teen flick. It needs to gross, by our standards, about $50 million to be considered a box office hit out of the box at just the movie theaters alone. And, you know, this movie's not there yet. Maybe it won't get there, but it's going to get close enough that it's going to be considered a hit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll probably top out at around 50.
Mm-hmm. But then it'll have a great life on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and all that. So it's going to be a successful film for the studio, for Fox, and it's going to play well and be a good part of their library. And it may be a good arrow for Greg Berlanti as he moves forward in his film career, expanding beyond TV and all the kids involved in the movie. And number 10 is The Boss Baby. I wonder what territory it opened up in. This animated film came out ages ago in the U.S., but it grossed $7 million this weekend, and that puts it over the $500 million mark. So this movie was already a hit, and now it has crossed the $500 million. It's now at $507 million worldwide. At number 11 is another teen flick here in North America. It's actually in 9 territories, but it shows you it's not easy. You know, you make these films for modest budget. You're not going to get a slam dunk every time. Midnight Sun is about a girl who has a rare disease that means she can't go outside in the sun. And it's apparently much more common in Japan than it is in the U.S. So they're hoping it'll do better there. It opened this weekend.
Actually, it's based on a Japanese film.
That's right. And it's and grossed $6 million. But they're hoping this English language remake will go back to Japan and register with them. It made $6 million in its opening weekend. Did pretty poorly in North America. It was number 10 with a $4 million and a very modest per screen average. Didn't get good reviews. Didn't get a good audience score. So it's probably going to come and go pretty fast. At number 12 is Operation Red Cheese, the Chinese war film about rescuing citizens in a war zone. That's at the $570 million worldwide mark. At number 13 is Game Night, another $6 million. That one is going to pass $100 million, which gets it close to the $120 million it needs to triple its reported budget. That's not a problem for The Shape of Water, the Guillermo del Toro Oscar winner for Best Picture and a whole bunch of other awards. That's at $185 million worldwide. And then there's Be With You, the Japanese weepy that we, the Korean weepy that's a remake of a Japanese weepy that we talked about last week. That's at $12 million worldwide. And moving down, here's a new film. It's Unsane. This is a Steven Soderbergh film. It's a horror flick shot on cell phones, and it stars Claire Foy of The Crown, who people were lambasting the TV people for not giving her more money. She's a big star, they said. Well, she didn't open this movie, that's for sure. It grossed $4.6 million on its opening weekend. It had poor reviews, and it's the lowest opening in by some measures for Steven Soderbergh in his entire career. Almost the opposite is true for Wes Anderson, who had a great opening for his animated film in limited release. That's Isle of Dogs. I'm really looking forward to seeing that one. Just on a few screens, it did terrifically here in the U.S. It grossed, did it break into the top 10? No, it's a little small, but it's in the top 15. It grossed almost $60,000 on per screen on 27 different screens. So a really high per screen average for that movie. Not close to the Grand Budapest Hotel, but it shows that people are eager to see his second animated feature.
Well, overall, box office was slow, at least in March, although, you know, let's face it, February was fantastic.
Exactly. They love to just, you know, the last two Marches have been, you know, groundbreaking for Hollywood. They've been opening big films that have big success stories. So this year, March wasn't as big as the last two record-setting years. So, of course, it's a disaster. The first quarter will be down in 2018 compared to the first quarter of 2017, which was, I think, the best of all time. So again, put it in context. You had the best February ever. March did not do as great. But some of the films that flopped in March in North America or were seen as underperforming are actually going to do okay overseas, like Tomb Raider and Pacific Rim Uprising. So North American box office is hugely important. It's the engine that drives the machine of North American entertainment for movies. But the worldwide box office is even more important. When you're making movies that cost $100 million or $150 million, you're playing a big game that involves the entire world, not just North America. Obviously, you always want to do well there. You get more money back from the box office than in almost any other territory. So you make more money when you have a big hit in the U.S. So it matters, but it's not the whole game.
Well, Marvel is certainly driving Disney, and they're going to drive them to the number one spot at the box office this summer. And they're driving Disney at the theme parks, at the box office. Disney is going to create Marvel-themed lands in at least 3 of their Disney theme parks.
Well, to clarify, they're amping it up. So they've had stuff going on. They've had stage shows and things like that.
Right.
But they're going to expand and continue. So you're going to see there's been Iron Man in some territories. There have been Guardians of the Galaxy. We've already had Spider-Man. And we're going to see a new live show in 2020. And they're building bigger and bigger attractions, rides. So that's happening at least in California, Disneyland Paris, and Hong Kong Disneyland. Those are the 3 first ones where they're doing stuff. But I mean, this is no surprise. We've had such a huge success story with, you know, film after film after film. They have, 4 or 5 Marvel movies coming out in 2018. So it's no shocker that they would do that. The only shock, I guess, is that it isn't farther along in the planning stages.
Yeah, and I guess certainly Black Panther will be a part of it because now it's the highest grossing superhero movie of all time.
Absolutely, and you want to reach out to Black families going on vacation. You want to be smart and give them something they can really feel is their own and feel that they're represented at the park in a way they've never been before. Certainly, you know, I can't think of any other way they would be. So when you go to Disney World and Disneyland, it's pretty darn white. So that's it. You know, when you're talking about the Latinx audience, the Asian audience, the Black audience, it's really smart to make your parks look as diverse as the people who come to them. But China is obviously a big market. Disney, they have Disneyland Shanghai. Is that what they have?
I think,
or Hong Kong Disneyland.
Hong Kong, yeah.
Yeah, it's Hong Kong. So Hollywood's doing business there. Are they going to be concerned about what the Chinese government has done about its film industry?
Well, you know, certainly when you look at what Pacific Rim did, right? I mean, the film was a flop here in the U.S., and so why do a sequel? Well, you could do a sequel because it did just monstrous business overseas, specifically in China. And you can see this weekend it did like $120 to $150 million in China alone. Well,
I think it did $68 million in China.
Oh, really?
In Pacific Rim?
Yeah, I was looking at...
maybe it's $150 million worldwide, and as we just reported, $68 million in China.
Okay, so I'm looking at some Ent Group reports here. This is what happens when you start like mixing and matching all of these box office reports. But, you know, we've been reporting over the past couple of weeks that China has been undergoing some government changes. You know, Xi Jinping is now president for life, for the most part. And the government did away with SARFT, which was the organization overseeing media and the press and television and movies. And now the government has placed the movie industry oversight into the Communist Propaganda Department.
And is that going to have any practical impact on Hollywood, or is that more about what's happening with their local cinema?
I don't know. It will be very interesting to find out. And I'm sure that, you know, there are a few Hollywood studios that wonder that too. Now, keep in mind that most, if not all, films going through to the Chinese market get released by the China Film Group. There's only like one or two distributors that are allowed to distribute films in China. So even if you are Warner Brothers or Universal or Sony and you're distributing a film in China, you're doing it with the China Film Group so that they get a piece of the action. So
nothing happens without government approval.
Oh yeah, not at all. And certainly I think listening to Chris Aronson, who is the head of distribution for 20th Century Fox, he said one of the reasons that, you know, the last Alien film didn't do well there, besides the fact that, you know, it may not have been as good as people had hoped, is that when they finally edited the film and censored the film, there were like one or two shots left of the alien. So it was, you know, a movie called Alien without the alien.
So, I mean, it, you know, when you're doing a business in a country like China or Russia, it's tricky. You're selling your soul to a degree. It's difficult. How much are you giving up? How much are you going to hurt your brand, perhaps, by the things that you do in one country when it comes to bite you in another? You know, we know Apple has been, you know, got to worry about where they make their products, how they make their products. And the same thing happens with movies. Where are you making your movies? Where are you having your film shown? And what control are you giving up to do that?
Well, and every year at CinemaCon, it used to be Chris Dodd, who was the head of the MPAA until recently, but it was Chris Dodd and John Fithian, the head of the National Association for Theater Owners. They do this press meet and greet after the state of the industry speech. And inevitably, they were asked, hey, what's going on with China? How come they're only still letting in 34 films officially? They're a part of the World Trade Organization. Doesn't that, you know, break a rule of the WTO? Why are they allowed in the WTO when they're not, you know, they don't have open borders for films? And there was always a lot of hemming and hawing and, you know, it's complicated. You know, we can't get into it. Now it'll be very interesting because with the current Trump administration putting
a trade war.
Yeah, tariffs basically on certain Chinese goods and China reciprocating. You know, Hollywood movies are a big export of the United States, specifically to China. It'll be interesting to see if China, you know, pushes back on Hollywood.
Well, I imagine if China's smart, they'll want to punish U.S. industries without hurting their own. So that may give movies a pass.
And the reason being is because, of course, they've built, I think they have the most movie theaters in the world in that country right now.
Right. And there are powerful billionaires who have invested in them that want to have Hollywood movies to show in their theaters. But speaking of passes and a movie, this week in Movie Pass, we have more news. A few weeks ago, it seems like they had lowered their price. It sounded like a lot, but when you added up the service charges, they were lowering their annual fee from $120 to, get this, $115. But you had to pay for the whole year in advance. Well, that was pretty lame, and we said so. Well, they've lowered their price again. Now it's down to $7 a month for new users only. You pay $7 a month, but you got to pay for the whole year in advance. There is a fee, but it's only like another $7. So the total for a year of MoviePass paying in advance is $90. Now that's $30 less than what I pay, and it's $25 less than their most recent plan. So that's a big jump down. That means your monthly fee of about $7 is less than the ticket price in almost every part of the country. When you're paying an evening ticket price at your local theater, you're probably paying more than $7. So now it's not just cheaper than the ticket price in New York and LA, it's now cheaper than the ticket price for a primetime performance pretty much anywhere in the country.
Yeah, you know, I think what they're trying to do here, the play here is to gain, a, basically, you know, ramp up, scale up, get so many people. Well, yeah, sell it, but also be able to say, look, we can drive a lot of traffic to your movies. And over the weekend, on Thursday, I was invited to a screening of the movie Flower that MoviePass was holding. They sent me, you know, hey, do you want to RSVP to this advanced screening of Flower? And I RSVP'd, unfortunately, was not able to attend. And then they asked me, hey, what did you think of Flower? Which I didn't see. But would you have seen this movie if it wasn't for MoviePass? And then I would get little texts over the weekend on my phone about, hey, go see Flower, which is kind of funny because technically they should have known that I, well...
Well, they're just going to send it. They're not going to adjust for the 20 people that went to a screening. They're just send it to everyone because they're advertising. So
right. And so they were really pushing this film.
Right. Well, that's obviously their ultimate idea is we'll make money some way down the road, either by marketing to our own customers, by getting a cut of concessions or something else from the theater chains, which is not going to happen, or having so many people that it just becomes worthwhile for them to work with us more closely. But basically, their plan is we're just going to grow so big that we can sell it and run away before we have to pay the piper. I mean, it's kind of like Amazon, they say. They say, look, we're just focusing on growth. The problem is you have to have some path to profitability. And while Amazon spent decades focusing on growth, they were profitable in this area and that area and the other area. They may have been kept reinvesting in their business overall, but they were buying up new businesses. They were expanding into cloud services. They were expanding into distribution so that they could get products to you more quickly. They were buying Whole Foods. Whereas with MoviePass, they're just getting more and more customers and losing more and more money with every person that they gain. They're not expanding into new areas where they can make money. They're just adding more and more people by lowering their price.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how they can transform that, if they can transform that, into any sort of break-even or profit.
Well, like we've said before, it's very clear that there is a demand and a desire for a pass to the movies. Charge a reasonable price like $20 or $25 a year. And there's a hardcore group of clearly now 5 million people, if not more, that will be willing to pay that price to be able to go to the movies as much as they want. And I think there's a value in allowing those early adapters and those passionate moviegoers to see more movies.
Wait, you said $20 to $25 a year. Did you mean per month?
I meant per month. I beg your pardon.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly how MoviePass started. And they only had 20,000 subscribers.
No. I know. But they, you know, I meant $10. I'm sorry, but you know, it's the prices have changed so much so frequently. It's getting confusing. It's $15. It's $10. It's $50. It's $7. So yeah. But I mean, ultimately, paying about I'm paying $10 a month. Clearly, there's a demand for that. I think there would be a demand, maybe even at $15 or $20. I think, you know, clearly you've got millions of people willing to jump in. So. You know, there's a market there. There's people there who will go to more movies than they would have otherwise. You might make more on concessions, and you've got those people giving the word of mouth. You know, people taking a chance on movies, going to see more movies, and they're the ones who spread the word. I think there's a market there. It just doesn't work as a business without having the theater chains and the studios on board.
Well, you're on board every year for the IRA Film Awards. You're one of the members of the IRAs, and it's a New York-based group that votes on the best films of the year, and they've been doing this every year since 1976, and once upon a time, they were featured in The New Yorker, in fact, and they're still going strong, and I guess over the weekend, you guys picked the best films from 2017, and I think for you, Michael, who loved a particular movie from France, you must be very happy.
Yeah, it was a great year for movies, and I saw a lot of good films. I was very happy with the winners at the IRA Awards. BPM, the French film that did win the César for Best Film of the Year, but it was ignored by the Oscars. Everybody thought it would be up for Best Foreign Film. It didn't make it. That winner was Una Mujer Fantástica, the Chilean film starring Daniela Vega. But the IRA Awards came out, and there were three big competitors, I think. There was BPM, The Florida Project, The Founder, starring Michael Keaton, and don't forget Call Me By Your Name, which was a sort of a dark horse in a lot of different categories, even though it didn't actually win anything. But the big winners are exactly those movies. BPM won Best Picture and Director and Editing. Daniela Vega actually won Best Actress for Una Mujer Fantástica. I thought she was terrific. And Michael Keaton won for The Founder. Now, that movie came out in 2016 in LA for Oscar contention, and it followed up on Michael Keaton's Oscar-winning films, Spotlight and Birdman. He was starred in Birdman, which won Best Picture. Then he starred in Spotlight, which won Best Picture. Then he starred in a film directed by John Lee Hancock, who's very commercial, did The Blind Side and other movies. And it's about the guys who founded McDonald's. That's a pretty damn big, well-known chain. And it just disappeared off the radar completely. Nobody paid attention to it, but it's a really good film. And Michael Keaton won Best Actor for The Founder, and the film won Best Screenplay. So I'm really glad that we brought attention to those films. And then we saw The Florida Project won Best Supporting Actor for Willem Dafoe, Best Cinematography, Best Production Design. We honored Good Time, the Safdie Brothers film, which had a great score. We gave that the Best Score or Best Use of Music Award. And so I'm really happy with this year. Our best documentary film was Dawson City Frozen Time, a really good film by Bill Morrison.
Why don't you explain what that's about? Because it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a film about Dawson City, which is a gold rush town in, I think, Alaska, and has all these odd connections to Hollywood. Turns out, like, all these stars appeared there. Of course, books were written about the gold rush and people who were there, but there were actors there who would come there to perform. The person who founded Grauman's Chinese Theater was at Dawson City. So was the guy who started the Pantages circuit chain. They started in Dawson City and made their fortune, or at least got a start in exhibition there. So there's all these weird connections to Hollywood. But what's also true is that Dawson City was the end of the line. Movies would, of course, tour the country. They didn't have wide distribution like they did. They had prints that would circle all over the country. A really big release might have 200 prints, but that was rare. Most movies had fewer prints than that, and they would start in the big cities and go to the suburbs and go to the smaller states. And eventually, maybe a year or two after it opened up, it would come to Dawson City. And at that point, we're talking like the 1910s and the 1920s. And at that point, you know, it was a battered old print. And the people there would say, hey, do you want your movie back? You want to pay for it to send it back to you? And the studio's like, no, destroy it, get rid of it. And so they would literally, with their other trash, they would wait until the spring thaw and then toss all these films in the river, which just breaks your heart. You think, oh my God, all these movies that were lost forever. But they didn't do that with everything. They stored some of them and ended up dumping them in a pool, an abandoned pool beneath an ice hockey rink in Dawson City, Alaska. And they were forgotten there for decades. And then in the 70s, they were digging it up and suddenly realized they had a treasure trove of, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of reels of silent films that were thought lost forever. So all these reels are, you know, they tell the documentary story about Dawson City. They tell about the discovery of these films, and interspersed throughout are clips from these faded, decrepit, decaying silent films that have been rescued from obscurity by film historians. So it's a really cool movie if you love cinema. It's got an interesting story as far as the gold rush and all the people that were there. It's a very good film.
Well, I love some of the IRA awards that you give out, like the Somonex Award, which is the movie that put us to sleep. You gave it to The Post.
That's right. And the Dramamine Award is no surprise. The movie that made us sick, the winner was Mother. And Mechanical Actress was Emma Watson for Beauty and the Beast and The Circle. And Mechanical Actor was James Franco for pretty much everything. So he was in like 17 movies this year. People do enjoy their nasty little barbs, but it's a fun evening. And we've got a link to the all the winners and nominees in our show notes. Even if you're haven't seen most of the winners, but there's a list of like 20 or 30 movies that we honored as nominees or winners. And we've got a list of our best picture winners going through the past. So there's a lot of great movies. If you have any interest in art films or serious cinema, you know, check them out. It's a pretty darn good list to start making sure you catch up on some of the best movies from around the world.
Well, that brings us to this week in reboots, sequels, spinoffs, and I think that's pretty much it. I don't think we can add another qualifier there. And this week, we're actually talking about, it's not really, is it a reboot? It's a spinoff, really, because it's the Griswolds, the folks, the family from the Vacation films. They're going, first they went to Europe, or first they just went to what? Wally World. Then it was, I don't know where they went, Europe.
European vacation.
Then it was a Christmas holiday. And now they're headed to the Great White Way, a Broadway vacation. A musical is in the works.
Yes, they're going to make a musical of the Griswolds. And a vacation film is going to come to Broadway. It's going to be a brand new one, Broadway Vacation. God help us all. You know, if there's money to be made, somebody will try and do it. That's certainly the case. I can predict another spinoff that will definitely happen. Stormy Daniels. She was on 60 Minutes. They reached 22 million people in the overnights. It was the highest rated 60 Minutes episode in a decade.
Wow.
It'll probably be the number one show of the week. And they're thinking to themselves, can we get another adult film star on? Can Stormy Daniels come back on? You know, how can we build on this franchise?
You know, it's funny because I've told people that, look, you know, Donald Trump has been, as a president, a godsend to the, you know, news outlets. They get to curse on television because, hey, we're just reporting the news. And the president said, why are we letting all these people from blank house or bleep house countries in? And so they got to say it again and again and again until the point where basically it was like, look, that news was last week. You can't keep saying that word. Then they actually started editing themselves. And now they get to like constantly show images of a porn actress because that is news now. And they're just eating it up.
Yes, well, the music industry is eating it up, at least with streaming, aren't they?
Yes, so, okay, this is the second year in a row where there was some growth in the recorded music industry. Revenue
double
was
double-digit growth.
Double-digit growth. The last time that happened was in 1994, which was kind of the heyday of the recording industry.
Well, actually, 1994 was a sort of a peak year for the right. music industry in terms of sales. That's when they hit $12 billion. So we're just saying, hey, it's great. We've had 2 years of growth, double-digit growth in a row. We're at $8.7 billion, but that's still well off the peak of 1994. So it's taken a decade for us to climb back to where we are. But the music industry is still only at about 60% of where it was in 94. And as Sperling would point out, that does not include adjusting for inflation.
Right. So revenue is back to 2008 levels. That's what we're saying here.
That's right. And it's growing and it's all happening from streaming, isn't it?
Yeah. So streaming is up 43% to $5.6 billion, which is 2/3 of all revenue now, which is coming from streaming. CDs and vinyl are outselling, ironically, digital sales. So the digital downloading is still not, well, I don't want to say still not, but it's not surpassing physical media.
Well, it's fallen back down. It did for a while.
Right.
People were buying singles and albums, and now it's fallen back down again because everyone is streaming. They just pay a monthly fee. In fact, 2/3 of all revenue come from streaming, and that leaped 43%. But it's not all good news, is it? First of all, keep in mind, music industry is bigger than just sales. There's also concerts and merchandising and things like that. But the RIAA emphasizes this is a fragile recovery, and they point the finger at a value gap. They say there's a value gap in the use of music by people like terrestrial radio and Sirius XM and YouTube who are using music and not paying their fair share. They should be paying more money back to the industry. Weirdly, the actual report put out by them sort of downplayed YouTube. They talked about Sirius and terrestrial radio and wagged the finger at them, but they didn't really mention YouTube by name a lot. They were only in like a chart here and there. And people pointed this out. I'm like, no, we're still angry at YouTube. Don't get us wrong. So YouTube is like the number one bad actor in terms of a value gap. As far as most people in the industry are concerned, they say they're not. But the RIAA is saying, yes, we're growing. It's great. There's a lot of work to do. And there's still a lot of people who are benefiting from music without paying their fair share.
Yeah, well, I think we always said, Michael, you know, that, and I've been saying, all the record executives I talked to, I was a very early adopter to Spotify. I was on it in 2009, and not legally here in the U.S. I think I signed up in Norway. And, you know, but the problem, of course, is that Spotify has slowed their growth. And they haven't slowed their own growth. It's just that fewer people are signing up. But all the record executives I talked to when Spotify and Apple Music and everybody was coming online said, look, once we hit 50 million subscribers, we should be in a revenue-generating mode. Well, now they're well over 50 million subscribers, but they're still not really making
money. Well, they're generating revenue. They just haven't made up all the revenue that they've lost.
Right. And certainly, it doesn't look like Spotify. I don't know how they're going to make any money.
Well, they have no path to profitability. Again, MoviePass is sort of the Amazon method. They say, we're focusing on growth, but they're not doing any other things or investing in different things. They're just losing money at what they're doing. But their growth is not slowing down. It's doing great. They've got more competitors. Amazon is growing a lot as well. But they predict growth of 20 to 30% in 2018.
Really?
You know, only in the crazy world of, you know, tech firms is that not good growth. They predict they will hit 92 to 96 million subscribers by the end of this year. They have 71 million subscribers now. Apple says it has 38 million paid subscribers. That doesn't include active monthly users. That's just people who are actually paying for their premium service. So that's 110 million people just from those two companies alone. So I'm probably looking with Tidal and others, Amazon, maybe we're at 115, who knows? But there's 150 million people worldwide paying a monthly fee to access streaming music. And there's still a lot of room to grow because there's 8 billion people on the planet. And Spotify's path to profitability, I guess, is going public because that's what they're doing April 3rd, next Tuesday.
Well, joining them shortly will be YouTube. And they actually plan on, and they have had a music service in the past, a subscription music service in the past. It was not very successful. In fact, it wasn't successful at all, mainly because people said, well, why do I need to pay for this? I can just, you know, create a playlist of music videos and then put it on in the background and, you know, just walk away and I might be cooking or doing the dishes or, you know, doing my homework or whatever. And it'll just be playing on another tab or something. I don't need to pay YouTube for this.
And YouTube said, thank you for pointing that out.
Yes. In fact, Lior Cohen, the company's global head of music, said, you know what? We're going to actually begin to frustrate you because we're going to start putting ads in between all of these music videos that you've just kind of lined up in a playlist. It'll sound a lot more like, I don't know, radio.
That's right. So they're going to use an algorithm. And when they see you listening to a lot of music in a row, they're going to put more and more ads in between there to encourage you to sign up for their streaming service. It makes sense. It's a right play. It doesn't change the royalty rate that they are paying back to the record industry, but it does help them sign up more people. Because you know what? If you're spending hours and hours listening to music on YouTube, you either should be listening to more ads or you should be signing up for a streaming service.
Well, here's my question. Okay, let's just take Spotify, for instance. 90 million users paying $10 a month, right? Isn't that like $9 billion?
No, well, that's $900 million a month, so that would be $10.8 billion a year worldwide.
How in the world is the music industry not making money off of that? Even if they say, okay, Spotify, for your doing this, we'll give you 30%. Okay, so there's your 30%. You get like, you know, $1.3 billion or whatever. And you know what? Would that be $1.3 billion? No, it'd be like $3 billion. We're going to take $7 billion out of it. How are they not making money off of that?
Well, they are slowly but surely. I mean, it grew by 43% this year. That's a lot. It's almost doubled this year. Well, almost grew by 50% to $5.6 billion. So, you know, it's happening. They're just not happy with the royalty rate that Spotify is paying them. Maybe you should be asking, why isn't Spotify making money?
That's what I mean.
They say we're paying too much.
Oh, well, okay. Maybe. I don't necessarily know. I don't have their books.
But I guess now they would say, we need 200 million people. If we get 200 million people to sign up, then that would be a big deal. And we'd really make the money. And then we'd start to have a lot more revenue coming in.
Now, I don't know if you meant to do it, but you did use two words in there. And they were deal and big. You can put them in any order you want. But that must mean it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, mon dieu, the Cannes Film Festival has made some major changes. Okay, they're minor changes unless you actually attend, but still. First of all, they are officially frowning on selfies on the red carpet. Okay, it creates traffic jams and is just tacky, so they're encouraging the stars to leave the photo taking to the thousands of press photographers lined up for precisely that reason. I always hated it when I was walking up the red carpet and there was some movie star in front of me trying to take a selfie. And journalists, by the way, will no longer be the first people to see the films in competition. Instead of a morning press screening followed by the official evening premiere, Cannes will keep competition films under wraps until the evening premiere and open a smaller nearby venue so critics can see a film at the same time as the rest of the world. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, the selfies is a big whoop. That's a perfectly reasonable ban. Hopefully the stars will accede to that. The press screening, and my initial reaction was like yours. Oh, my God, that's terrible. When Terry Frimo explained himself, I felt a little more empathy. He said, look, we just want it to be an event. When the movie premieres in the evening, we don't want everyone to already know what it's thought about it and say, oh, it's a bomb, it's a turkey. You know, before you get there, there's all these reviews are printed. Everybody knows the word of mouth. The buzz spreads by like wildfire. He says, look, we just want when that movie to premieres to be exciting that no one has seen it before. And right now, thousands of journalists see it and the word gets out and you feel like you're sort of second run. So I have empathy with that, but it's going to create a lot of unexpected problems, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you pull on a thread on your sweater and the other, you know, the thread is gone, but you're right, the sleeve on the other hand falls off. So you know what I'm saying. What it will do is certainly for films that then screen at 10 o'clock. So there's like a 7 o'clock premiere, which is like the big film of the day. That will be shown at the same time in the theater next door. So there's the big grand Lumiere theater, holds 2,100 people. And then there's the smaller, you know, I think it's 1,200 to 1,500 seat Debussy right next door. They will, the press will be in the Debussy screen.
And what they've created is a scrum and an angry mob of critics every night, because they're the only people who will be able to get in were people with pink and white badges. Nobody with a blue or yellow badge, which is most of the journalists, will be able to get in. But even the pink and white badges are going to be fighting each other to get in because they won't all fit.
And then you'll have a 10 o'clock show of another premiere film. That film will screen the next morning. Here's what's going to happen. That film will show, okay, and if it's bad, you'll wind up hearing about it and you won't wake up to go see the film. So then you're actually cutting the audience in, you know, probably half for some of these competition films.
Right. You've got journalists coming from all over the world, and the biggest venue at the place is the 3,000-seat Lumiere. Almost every journalist can get into that for every single movie in competition. So that's most movies are shown there. You wake up really early, you go in, you trudge there, and you see the movie. Now, since you can't see the movie in advance, you're going to hear the word of mouth from the other critics or from the world premiere screening. And when they say, do I want to wake up the next morning, about half those films are going to be ignored, because about half the competition films just aren't that good. Maybe they're saying, you know what, we don't care about, you know, missing out on half of negative reviews. But the fact is, you go see the film, then you go to the press conference, maybe you write a story, get a quote from the director, you're just not going to bother. So they're taking the oxygen out of the air for all those competition films, and people are going to find it much easier to ignore the ones that aren't great right out of the bat. So they're going to find out, you know what, we got a lot of less publicity for our film, even though it played in competition. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, I saw a film last year by Naomi Kawase called Radiance, which was about descriptive narrative over films. And I never would have seen that. I was covering it for Celluloid Junkie. I never would have seen that film if others hadn't seen it first, told me what it was about. And I said, oh my God, I can't believe I missed that film. I need to cover that. I went and saw the film. Now I'm seeing, you know, I would never catch this film.
Well, I'm saying that's word of mouth working in a good way.
Yes, correct.
Right. So that happens when a movie is seen, even by the 3,000 critics, then people rush to see it even more. And so even the evening screenings is more fun. The fact is, you're sparing people a couple hours, I guess, of misery. I mean, they usually know if they have a bomb or not. So it's not really a surprise to them when the critics go and go, oof, you know, you know what the hot tickets are. So I guess they're sparing the filmmakers. That's the only upside for them, I guess, that nobody sees in advance. There's a sense of excitement and the filmmakers get a few extra hours where they can pretend their movie is going to be really great.
And there are other ways to solve the problem that Terry Frimo is talking about. Certainly, there could be embargoes and things like that, which, you know, would actually work in Cannes, because, you know, they're very good about not inviting you back if you break an embargo.
Right. You mean saying if you didn't want the word to get out, you wouldn't be able to tweet or post your review until after the actual world premiere.
Correct.
They must have considered that. But
I'm sure they did. I'm sure this is also in part to please not only the filmmakers, but the distributors as well. Now, speaking of distributors, Cannes is also standing by its ban on movies that don't plan a theatrical run in France. The festival won't allow films into competition unless they agree to a theatrical run in France. Director Steven Spielberg is in agreement. He says the Academy Awards are right to frown upon movies that will basically be seen only on streaming services, and he would go farther. Spielberg says even movies with a pro forma qualifying run of 1 week somewhere in a theater in Oklahoma should be ignored when it comes to awards. And that's nothing against Oklahoma. We could have used any state or any small town. The Oscars are about big movies being shown on the silver screen for a wide audience. Getting your film technically eligible but basically being seen only online shouldn't count. If you make a TV movie, you get to win an Emmy. Oscars are for movies that people see in the cinema. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's just one person's opinion, but he holds a lot of weight and he makes some sense. I don't know if there's an easy way to say, okay, you've technically qualified, but we're going to ignore you anyway. But I think maybe the voters are already doing that. They're sort of not, they didn't embrace the Meyerowitz stories that maybe would have had some possibility. Or, you know, I think they're feeling if a film's not an event and it hasn't been seen in theaters, they're probably less likely to embrace it. You know, a small art film is one thing, but a big studio movie that goes right to Netflix is quite another.
Well, and you basically, this stemmed, at least for the Cannes, from Cannes on the Netflix issue. They invited a bunch of films from Netflix last year, and there was a big uproar because Netflix, I guess they screened a day and date in a movie theater for a week in like one or two theaters, but they said, no, we're not going to
guarantee a theatrical run. Yeah.
Right. And there is a chronology of media in France where there are certain laws in place that when a film screens in a movie theater, you know, it only appears on video after certain periods of time. And so Netflix said, yeah, well, for streaming, that's a 36-month window. We're not going to do that.
Right. But, you know, they can still be a con that just can't be in competition. So they can get attention. They can have out of competition. They can be in other categories. So they'll have a presence at con. And that law needs to be tweaked as well. But, you know, it's a compromise. It'll all work out.
I loved what Terry Fermeau had to say about Netflix, though. He said, you know, last year when we selected these two films, I thought I could convince Netflix to release them in cinemas. I was presumptuous. They refused. He went on to say, the Netflix people loved the red carpet and would like to present with other films, but they understand that the intransigence of their own model is now the opposite of ours. I love that. Saudi Arabia is getting serious about movies. The monarchy, well, they see movies as both a growth industry, a smart way to diversify its oil income, and a good PR move. So the government is setting up the Saudi Film Council. That ends a 35-year ban on movie theaters by the kingdom and will be followed by investment in movies and theaters overseen by Crown Prince Salman. Hollywood execs are already lining up to do business. Saudi Arabia has 30 million people, with a majority of those under 25 years old. Since Prince Salman seized power, theater chains like AMC have had the green light to build cinemas, and movies started a handful of screenings in March. It's considered the biggest Middle Eastern market yet to be fully exploited. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and like China, proceed with caution. Because, yes. You know, what are you selling? What are you selling off? What piece of your soul are you selling to do business there? Are you going to alienate the people in that country long term by doing business with the government? It's a lot of things to think about before you jump in and just say, hey, there's money to be made.
Yeah, I mean, I know a couple of the people who have gone to Saudi Arabia when, you know, prior to their announcing the opening of the market, they were working with the government to help arrange it. And they said, you know, that the new government, whether it was seized, you know, I guess Prince Salman seized power, as you say, that the one thing the government knows is that a majority of their population is under the age of 25. They're on the internet. And the former government was very conservative, very, if you want to call it, old school, and that they needed to start making some changes and kind of being a little bit more progressive. That's one of the things they noticed.
Let's not say progressive. Let's just say less repressive, perhaps.
Okay, that's
letting
another
people go to, letting people go to the movies, though if you're a woman, God forbid if you step outside of your house without your husband or brother by your side. So it's not exactly progressive. Let's just say there's money to be made in Saudi Arabia and Dubai, just like there was money to be made in apartheid South Africa, but that's the choice you are making. Personally, I've been offered free trips to go to film festivals in Dubai with lovely, luxurious hotels. I would be ashamed of myself if I went, and so should everybody else.
Now, 6 weeks after buying up the magazine publishing company Time Inc., new owners Meredith has fired 200 employees and plans to fire 1,000 more in the weeks to come. It's also looking to sell off Time, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Money, and their related brands. How much money do you have, Michael? Can we?
I don't know.
Can we buy one of these?
Maybe. I would take Sports Illustrated, I think.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I wouldn't want Time.
Yeah, there's too many general interest magazines. They've already dumped Time Inc. UK and Golf Magazine, by the way. Those magazines don't fit into its focus on family and lifestyle titles like Better Homes and Gardens, Family Circle, and Parents. So Meredith will retain the cash cow People, Entertainment Weekly, In Style and Shape, Travel and Leisure, so on. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. We knew this was going to happen. I mean, that's you buy up a new company, then you streamline. You save with efficiencies by firing lots of people in the back rooms, like accounting and advertising and folks like that, because you don't need two advertising departments. You don't need two accounting departments. So we saw this coming. It's a sad reality of life. I'm just still shocked that Entertainment Weekly is around.
So same here.
I mean, that thing had no ads at the end. It was just all ads from Time Warner. And I mean, maybe they're doing some successful stuff online, or I'm not sure where the money is in that one, but God bless them.
In a closely watched verdict, the court ruling which said the Robin Thicke single Blurred Lines owed a debt to Marvin Gaye was held up on appeal. Many music industry watchers hoped that the potentially influential verdict claiming a vibe or sound could be copyrighted would fail. That didn't happen. On the other hand, the appeal focused on the legal maneuvering, suggesting that the case was lost by lawyers and not on the merits as such. But there were no grounds for overturning. The verdict said this was a cautionary tale for lawyers, not a sea change for music. It also poo-pooed the idea that the verdict would have a wide-ranging impact or spawn a host of copycat lawsuits. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because I don't think we're done yet on this. Maybe there's room for a further appeal. I don't know if they're going to do that. It was kind of a fascinating verdict. Like, no, this is not about the actual music stuff and whether they could play the sound recording rather than just show the sheet music. It was about the legal maneuvering, and these guys blew it. And that's all we can rule on. We cannot second guess the jury. Then no laws were broken. And we don't think it's a landmark case. We don't just look at it and we say there's no grounds for overturning what they decided. We may not even agree with it, but that's the case. But then they went on to say, oh, you people so worried. Don't get worried. It's not going to be a big deal. I'm like, I don't know. A lot of people felt like this was a really unusual ruling that had a lot of implications. They insist it doesn't, but we'll have to find out in the years to come. But it did set an unpleasant precedent. Hopefully other courts and judges will see it as just a technical ruling rather than one with broad implications. But I'm not sure about that.
Last week, we reported on the Broadway concert event Rocktopia and the puny contracts offered to the non-union singers in the chorus, salaries that amounted to about $30 a show in an 8-show week. Well, the producers of the show and Actors Equity reached an agreement that means a raise for the chorus and perhaps a precedent for future concert shows appearing on Broadway. Those may become more and more frequent. Certainly Bruce Springsteen could keep his show running forever. He's extended it one more time through December of 2018, but the boss insists that's it. His only backup singer is wife Patti Scialfa, or Scialfa, I always mispronounce her name, on two songs, and if she isn't paid fairly, we can imagine she's got a lot more leverage than the kids of Rocktopia. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal if it becomes a precedent. The Springsteen thing is no big deal unless I win the lottery, can actually afford a ticket. So that won't matter to me, but I had a friend who saw it the other night and just said it was just impeccable. It was just wonderful. I actually saw Rocktopia last night. I can't review it until tomorrow night, but I was deeply focused on the chorus of backup singers, knowing they were getting such little money. And they're on these platforms above the stage. It's a show which mishmashes rock music and classical music. It's just but these kids, they look like they were just corralled off the streets, put on the stage, and like, what do we do? What do I do? Like, they're all sort of like moving along, and they've got books out to sing along with the show because they're different in every city. You know, wherever they go, they recruit local people to sing in their choir. There are about 28 people on those rafters singing along, and I just found them fascinating. I couldn't stop watching them, thinking like they get $30 a show and they don't really know what to do. There's been very little rehearsal. Suddenly they're on a Broadway stage singing background music, singing to, you know, Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. It's a little surreal.
Well, you know, there was an interesting article in the New York Times, or an interesting feature in the New York Times, about the building in New York. I think it's on 43rd or 42nd Street that is the rehearsal space for all of these Broadway shows.
And I've not been able to play that. It's like a video. And like every time I try to look at it, it just doesn't work for me. I don't know why, but anyway.
Don't play it in Safari. Play it in another browser.
Ah, okay.
It's fascinating. It's, you know, you see Hamilton on one floor and Frozen on another, and the...
Yeah, there's a rehearsal space with multiple studios. You walk by and you can look up, and some of these spaces you can see dancers perform, you know, dancing and rehearsing and practicing. You know they're working on some Broadway show, but you don't know what. And this gives us a behind-the-scenes peek at, like, this crucible where all these different shows on different floors are being developed, worked on, and prepped before they can move into the actual Broadway space. Because, of course, there's probably a show in the house where you're going into, like maybe Bruce is there and you're going to go in January of 2019. He's still there. So you practice at the rehearsal space and then you move into the big house and you start more rehearsals there actually on site. So it's kind of cool to get a background glimpse.
Or you have national tours that are gearing up.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course.
And as far as Springsteen, the big deal there, if there is one, is that the only people who can buy tickets are those that have already signed up. So, in other words,
well, they had way more people sign up than could get tickets.
Right.
So, you know, like a million people signed up and said, "I'd love to buy a ticket." And if you didn't win in the earlier lotteries, they let you keep trying. They figure, why add in more people to the mix? There's no point. You know, most people aren't going to get in no matter what. So why add to the pool?
Right.
So it's just, you know, it's, I don't think they're punishing people. Really, people knew about it. They wanted to sign up. They could have. There you go.
Comedian Byron Allen has slowly acquired a media empire. His company, Entertainment Studios, has bought niche linear channels like Pets.tv and Comedy.tv and Cars.tv. Now he's made his biggest acquisition yet, the Weather Channel. Byron Allen controls the weather? Oh, just the Weather Channel.
Which they're going to change to the WeatherChannel.tv.
Exactly. That company was bought for $3.5 billion a few years ago, but its digital operations were sold off to IBM for around $2 billion. Now the remaining pieces of the company have been snapped up by Allen for just $300 million. Allen's movie arm enjoyed a big hit in 2017 with 47 Meters Down and some critical favor for the Christian Bale movie Hostiles. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal when you look at how much Weather Channel has fallen, you know, maybe a value of about $1.5 billion, but so many people get their weather from an app, from their phone, from this and that they don't need to tune into the Weather Channel anymore, at least not the way they did before. So that's how quickly things can change in the digital realm and the TV realm. But I have to say, Byron Allen, kind of a milquetoast comedian, and oh my God, his company name, Entertainment Studios. Could that be more milquetoast of a name? Is he like trying not to offend anybody?
Can I tell you something about Byron Allen? I mean, he's he's here in LA, right? And so when I was on the press junket.
I'm sure he's a lovely person.
Oh, he's very nice. When I was on the press junket circuit and was doing the rounds, you know, for years, I would go to these press screenings and he was always there because, of course, he did these celebrity interviews.
Oh, yes.
Where, you know, on television, and they would air at like 3 a.m. you know, or 2 a.m. And I'd always go, how are you making money doing this? But
apparently he was.
Everybody knew him and everybody liked him. But it was always kind of like this inside, oh, there's Byron. You know, like, oh, come on.
And he's getting the last laugh, isn't he?
Oh, he is so getting the last laugh. He's like a big mogul now.
I'd like to talk to him about his business. Yeah, who knew?
Now, the battle of concert venues continues, and rocker Ozzy Osbourne, he doesn't like it. You know the battle royale we're talking about? If you book a concert at, say, the O2 Arena in London, then you'll be blackballed from booking a show in New York or LA or other major venues by competitors. Similarly, the owner of O2, namely AEG, says you can't book a concert at London's biggest venue, the O2 Arena, unless you also agreed to do a show at the Staples Center when you come to Los Angeles, and so on. In other words, the owners of these concert sites want worldwide exclusivity for your tour. Play all our venues or else. Now Osbourne has filed an antitrust lawsuit saying O2 is a must-have venue in London, while other cities have a wealth of competing sites, and he shouldn't be locked in because of one choice in one city a continent away.
Actually, what he said was, what? I imagine it was his lawyers who said that. But anyway.
Yeah, big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. He's got a good case. He signed the deal. He's moving there, but it's so explicit in the contract. Play this venue or you don't play that venue. And if you play this venue, you want to play here, you got to play there. That, you know, I think he'll have a good case. It'll be fast. I'm hoping he has no reason not to take it all the way through because he's retiring. And I think he just wants to make a point. He's got enough money to do it. Thank you, MTV. And I hope he sticks to his guns.
Yeah, you know, ultimately, you know, the Forum here in Los Angeles, Madison Square Garden in New York, they're owned by the same company, right? So you play one, you play the other. AEG owns Staples Center, and I believe they own the venue in Brooklyn where the Nets play. And, you know, the O2 Arena in London. So they basically want you to play all those venues. This is part of these 360 deals, right? Where they manage you, yeah. they have all the venues for you to play in, they sell your tickets. It's, you know, now there's some antitrust issues going along with that. And I knew that that would happen at some point, and certainly here it comes. Now, the Library of Congress has added 25 sound recordings to the National Registry. We've got a link to hear some of the actual recordings, which include everything from the concert recording An Evening with Groucho Marx to the Kenny Loggins single Footloose. Cut loose, kick off the Sunday shoes, please, Louise. They all have, you know, they go all the way back to 1911. And the Victor Herbert Orchestra's selection from the operetta Naughty Marietta. Also in the mix, Steve Reich, Arlo Guthrie's Thanksgiving staple, Alice's Restaurant Massacre, Run DMC's Raising Hell, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, and the movie soundtrack for The Sound of Music. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I guess, but I love it every year. It's fascinating what they pull out of their hats. I love saying the operetta Naughty Marietta. It's just, it sounds like a line from Gilbert and Sullivan to begin with. I think this time around, there are fewer historical documents, you know, audio clips that we've seen more of in the past, though they do include a 1928 recording of the Yonktoni tribe in the Dakotas and a 1945 UN conference. Most of them are more familiar music stuff like Yo-Yo Ma, Le Freak, the disco hit by Chic, Kenny Rogers' single The Gambler, and Harry Belafonte's classic album Calypso, and so on. So, you know, it's a fun mix of stuff. Good to check out.
My kids love that song, The Gambler.
Oh, yeah, of course. Kids love story songs. They really do. It has a beginning, a middle, and end. You feel like it's going somewhere. I ate it up as a kid. The first album I ever bought on cassette, Kenny Rogers' Greatest Hits.
Jack, get back. Come on before we crack. Anyway, the story
That's in the Library of Congress, buddy. So lose your blues. Everybody cut Footloose. All right.
This story comes to us from listener James Gardner, who passed it along via email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Remember when people argued that if you made content available cheaply and easily, that people wouldn't bother with stealing it?
And by people, we mean me.
Yeah, well, that's coming true, right? I mean, just look at the exploding growth of online streaming services like Spotify, or how the book industry's most popular format is the ebook. Well, not so fast. A new study from the piracy tracking outfit Musso, or is it MUSO? I don't know. It insists that visits to piracy sites went up last year. The U.S. has 28% of the traffic, Russia has 20%, India has 17%, and so on. There has been one change. Instead of downloading pirated copies, more and more people are streaming them. Progress, I say. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I want to say it's a big whoop in the sense of, I think more and more people are getting access to the internet and broadband speed. So with more of it's happening, I think we're seeing less impact on actual commercial sales. They're rebounding from that. So I don't think every pirated copy is an inherent loss of a sale. Just like when you make, you know, I think it's never good. You want to fight it whenever possible. But I think in context, you've got 28% of it's happening in the U.S. That's also a huge market where they're making a lot of money. So I don't know if the news is all bad. You know, I'd love to break it down, see what they're doing, how much they're watching of each thing. What are they watching? Is it stuff that they knew they'd want to see anyway? Or are they sampling? You know, I'd love more granular detail.
Well, now, you know, from 2016 to 2017, there was a 1.6% increase, which is, you know, it's an increase, but it's not, you know, a 20% increase, not double-digit growth. That said, and I know somebody's going to say, well, what about China? Isn't everybody, you know, so gung-ho about China being the big pirates here? We always hear about that in the media. They came in 18th place, though keep in mind that the tracking and reporting of piracy from China, it's underreported because they're not necessarily, there's not a lot of ways to gain access to that information.
And the same may be true in India and Russia. It's hard to track, you know, people doing illegal things, period.
Right.
And of course, I try to look up Musso. They are a company that specializes in tracking piracy, I guess, which means they might have a dog in that fight and want to see piracy is still a big problem. I'm not saying they've fudged the numbers. I just would have liked to learn more about them, how they do their methodology, what the report actually shows. Hey, look, when stuff's available for free online, people are going to check it out. But I think we've seen that the general idea that if you make it available inexpensively and easily, people will access. It's just not worth their bother to do piracy. They're still doing it. It's still happening all over the world. But at least the problem is slowing down, if not going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, and that's good news. Now, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And remember, last week we talked about how marketing faith-based films has become more difficult now that the genre has taken off and there are a glut of such titles. The same may be true of LGBTQ films in the not-too-distant future. In fact, Travell Anderson recently wrote in the Los Angeles Times, as Hollywood continues conversations about inclusion and diversity, the distinctive outlooks LGBTQ filmmakers bring have become a calling card. Call it the queer gaze. Travell Anderson is a film reporter with the Los Angeles Times, covering the intersections of diversity in Hollywood with a focus on black and queer film. He joins us now to talk about two of his recent pieces on the subject. Travell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Travell, as everyone knows, there's a long history of black and queer representation in cinema, both good and bad, going back to the silent era. And you could talk about that intersection from now until doomsday with all the films that have already been made. But in your time at the LA Times, it seems like you have gone from writing about scrappy little independent films to the best picture winner at the Oscars, Moonlight, and the biggest superhero film of all time in North America, Black Panther, and now a Hollywood studio making Love, Simon, a film about a gay teenager coming out. That has to be a mind-twisting change in what you're covering and talking about.
It's really interesting. You know, I've only been at the Times for about 4 years. And like you said, in that 4 years, the industry has changed so much to where what I was initially covering was just like these small one-off movies that, you know, our audience probably wasn't interested in, to now these black and queer movies are the ones taking all of the headlines from the trades to the local, you know, newspaper in Idaho. It's really interesting to kind of witness the development of the industry through my work and then these types of films that we're now talking about.
Well, now, is it, because I was confused as to, is it queer film or LGBTQ film? What is the genre? I mean, what do we call the genre? Or does it matter? Does it not matter?
I don't think it matters, but I think kind of intellectually queer cinema would be like the genre, kind of the historical genre we would place a lot of these films in. But then, you know, the whole idea in conversation around LGBTQ identity is kind of a ever evolving one. And so whether people like to be called a queer filmmaker when they may not necessarily identify as queer, that's a constant, you know, debate point. But for the purposes here, I think calling it queer cinema or LGBTQ cinema, whichever rolls off your tongue easiest, would work.
And Sperling, you dropped the I, but we'll let you slip on that one. It's okay. Don't worry about it. So what brings us here today is Love, Simon, a film that opened up last week from Fox. It did great in its opening weekend. The Christian film, I can only imagine, did even better. They both really did well with critics and audiences. And second weekend, both have had really good holds. I Can Only Imagine had a great hold. Love, Simon had a very good hold. So they both they're both going to be profitable. So that's really good news, because that just means more movies get made, because Hollywood is here not to change minds and hearts, but to make money. I think we're talking about the marketing of this movie, and Fox is the first major studio to sort of market this in this way. And I think in a way they had it easy. Some people, I think they had a really clever, good campaign, but as long, they didn't need to be coy. Like Black Panther, the very uniqueness of the film is its own best marketing. If they tried to avoid that in any way, it would have been a disaster.
I mean, I think that's very true, but we've seen in the past when there are prominent queer characters in films that a lot of times the studios shy away from that, in part, I think, because they feel as if, you know, they want the film to be as marketable to as broad an audience as possible. As you mentioned, they're interested in making money. And so sometimes playing up the gay character or the queer character in a film, you know, it might, you know, other some of those people, you know, in the flyover states who you really want to turn out and be your audience for your film. And so we've seen that we've never really had something like this, particularly from a major studio that kind of owns its queer identity and its tongue in cheek in terms of how it's promoting the film.
Now, how did they do that? How did they own it?
So as I understand it, basically the marketing team, they saw the film early and they all really loved it. And they tried to figure out a concept that was true to the identity of the film. And so they picked up on this text-based marketing campaign. They called it a Dear Blank campaign. And basically they chose about 12 cities throughout the country where they had these, you know, billboards and bus stop signs that read, "Dear insert city here," and then it had some type of cheeky line. So like here in Los Angeles, they have "Dear LA, which way to WeHo, asking for a friend, love, Simon." And so it's like it's kind of cheeky, it's interesting. And then in WeHo, the signs in WeHo read, "Dear WeHo, I'm no longer keeping my story straight, love, Simon." And so it's kind of young and energetic and vibrant in terms of like the perhaps core audience that they're targeting without erasing kind of the queer identity and kind of the climax, if you will, of the particular film.
And now we should probably tell our listeners who don't live in Los Angeles that WeHo stands for West Hollywood. And Michael, do you know what West Hollywood is known for besides being the heart of Los Angeles? When, you know, it's pretty much right next to Beverly Hills.
Well, so I would always think of Silver Lake, but West Hollywood, gay area, like, you know, Chelsea or the Greenwich Village in New York City.
Okay.
Precisely.
The great campaign here in New York, it said, Dear New York, if I can come out here, I can come out anywhere. And, you know, just the tagline of the ad campaign was, you know, love, Simon, coming out this March. You know, so that's just everything worked together very well. It was confident, smart, funny, intriguing. It was a really good ad campaign in the print division. And obviously on TV and the trailers, they didn't try and pretend. They were very clear about what the movie was. It wasn't coy. You knew this was a kid coming out and realizing he was gay or getting ready to tell people. So I think you got to play to your strength, right? If you tried to do anything else, it just would look awful. You know, you'd be ashamed of your movie.
Definitely. But they also, you know, also just to point out one thing that they did in order to, you know, make sure that the film was still marketable and open to a broad audience is the tagline that they came up with was "Everyone deserves a first love story." And so that was one of their ways of generalizing kind of the content and context of the film to ensure that everyone knows that they can go see this movie and it may center a gay teen, but you're still going to take something away from it.
Now, we've had lots of Hollywood movies about gay characters and sometimes even the lead character. I mean, Kevin Klein came out in and Out, a Hollywood movie inspired by an Oscar campaign speech. It doesn't get any gayer than that. So there have been adult characters and teen gay characters in movies. But truly, as far as we can tell, this is the first studio-backed film with a lead character who is a gay teenager. And that's kind of amazing that it's this long, because when you start to list all the gay films that have been directed, there's a ton of them and a lot of important, well-made, terrific movies. I mean, way back, but, you know, even like Brokeback Mountain, Boys Don't Cry, Pariah from Dee Reese, who had good success with Mudbound this year, The Totally True Adventures of Two Girls in Love, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Clueless had a gay character. I mean, there's a lot of movies that you can look to. I mean, there are entire books written about, you know, queer cinema. So it's amazing that it's taken this long. But you look at the hard row for people of color, for Black people, for Asian people. I guess it's no surprise there aren't a lot of Hollywood studio films about Hispanic and Latino people either, are there?
And I would just add that, you know, I think one of the parts that makes Love, Simon even more so unique and different is that the gay character doesn't have AIDS, doesn't die at the end, doesn't have this kind of, you know, stereotypical tragic storyline that many of those films that you listed that their characters actually have. And so, and you know, the gay character's not the sassy best friend, you know, they're not the fashion guru. And so the kind of, this film kind of, you know, undoes some of those archetypes that gay people are typically, you know, said to embody.
And I was confused because there were no sheep. I mean, usually great gay films, Brokeback Mountain, even the UK film God's Own Country, there's usually sheep involved. And I was surprised by that, but I thought that was a good choice too.
We're moving forward. Progress.
Yes, moving forward. Fewer animals, more teenagers.
Spoiler alert. First of all, character doesn't die and there are no sheep. Now you've ruined the movie for me.
There's a lot more to get from it. Trust me.
Well, go ahead, Michael.
The film fits right in with what teenagers are reading and watching on TV. This is based on a best-selling young adult novel, so you've checked that box. There was a recent film which had a gay supporting character, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. The lead character actually seemed a little bit sexually confused for a while. We weren't sure what was going on with him, but that was a very commercially successful film, and that book was a bestseller. And now we've got... we've got this kid who is out and open and just relaxed about it. And the funny thing about this movie, for you especially, is how the film is also about a teenage interracial romance, ultimately. And that isn't even a box that they seem to think about as an issue. And I don't even know whether their audience does. And that's kind of a fascinating fact, that this film could have been 20 years ago about two teens who are of different races falling in love. And that would have been the entire story. In this film, I almost want to think it's an afterthought.
Very much so. I mean, I think this film, it's so effortlessly diverse in terms of kind of the main friend group being of a variety of people of different, you know, backgrounds and sexual orientations and identities and things like that.
Benetton ad.
Well, it definitely, I think it reflects some of the high school communities that we see today. Like my high school was very much kind of integrated in that particular way. But oftentimes when we see teen movies, right, we don't see Black characters. We don't see Latino characters or Asian characters or gay characters. It often just seems like the high school world is kind of in a bubble of its own. And it's in, you know, it's in some suburban area where they don't have people of color.
But you do see that on TV, and Hollywood is catching up with television, as it is so often doing lately in terms of content. You know, MTV alone has had shows like Awkward and others that have had a mind-blowing array of characters, lead characters who are transgender, gay, bisexual, three. I mean, I watch some of these shows and my jaw drops that this is what kids are watching. You're like, oh my God, this is so progressive. I can't even handle it. That's how old I am. It's so I think kids who have grown up with that, and we know the power of The Real World and other reality shows where gay and lesbian characters are just an everyday occurrence at this point. So I think kids are so used to that, they don't even think, oh, they're just seeing a movie about a kid. I really think it might be as simple as that. It's a well-reviewed movie about a kid in high school. Not about, oh, it's a gay movie. And they may not even see it as such like that because there's friendships and there's tension and there's, you know, people who are just friends and all that sort of stuff. So they market it in a way. They weren't ashamed of the coming out story, but it wasn't what the whole movie hung on. It was about a romance and it was about friends in high school. And I think that, you know, I worked for this movie.
Very much so. I mean, it's told in the John Hughes-esque style of those classic kind of teen dramedies. And so it's a very special film in that way, where it's like you literally could have seen this movie and probably saw this exact movie before, but you've never seen it with these characters. And I think you're right. Young people today, they're not looking at this and saying, oh, my God, wow. It's us older folks who are like, oh, wow, I wish I had this movie when I was younger.
Well, actually, that might be a good transition point here to talk about something else you wrote about, which is, you know, much like, say, back in, I remember when Norman Jewison was going to make the Malcolm X film and Spike Lee said, well, that movie should not be made by a white filmmaker. It should be made by an African-American filmmaker. He went on to make the film. You kind of write about the queer gaze, that it's no longer filmmakers that are straight trying to make films that are tackling queer or LGBTQ subjects. It's actual, you know, gay or lesbian or transgender filmmakers that are making films about their own world.
So, yeah, I mean, we've seen, you know, well, first and foremost, you know, the male gaze, everyone probably is familiar with, but it's basically having art filtered through a perspective that is typically from a white heterosexual male. Over the last few years in TV, we've seen conversation about the female gaze kind of pop up with shows like Queen Sugar and Jessica Jones that have all female directing teams, with shows like, you know, The Handmaid's Tale and Harlots and all these other examples, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Jane the Virgin, with women kind of staking claim with their narratives and telling their stories. I think now, over the last year or so, we've seen queer people in particular kind of been given the space to tell their stories and to own their stories. And so you have Angela Robinson with Professor Marston and Wonder Woman from last year. You have Andrew Haig. You have Greg Berlanti again with Love, Simon. You have Sydney Freeland with her story, and Deirdre and Lainey, Robert Train. All these LGBTQ filmmakers who are telling LGBTQ stories and bringing a different vantage point, a different perspective on these stories. So whether it's in the depiction of sexual intimacy between characters, whether it's in the depiction of loneliness and longing for love, we're seeing queer people be a part of these stories in a way that we haven't seen before.
And it's important and useful for Hollywood, not just for films about queer people. I mean, we've had the queer gaze throughout Hollywood history, you know, Douglas Sirk and John Waters and a million other people. What's his name? He directed George Cukor. You know, there's the queer gaze has been there from the beginning, and it creates a diversity and a richness that enlivens all subject material, not just about a gay teen coming out.
Very much so. And, you know, but I think the interesting part is we often have not named the queer gaze when we see it. The conversations about what we're looking at often rest at just the male gaze versus the female gaze. We might have a little bit of conversation about what people of color bring to a story that a white director might not, you know, as you mentioned with the Malcolm X example and Spike Lee. But we really haven't, you know, put a name to LGBTQ people actually being important integral members of Hollywood and what they bring to a story, particularly when that story is not an LGBTQ story. And so I think what we're seeing right now is we have LGBTQ filmmakers who definitely want to tell LGBTQ stories and have a platform to do so, but they are also interested in bringing their perspectives to, you know, stories that aren't necessarily queer. I'm thinking of Andrew Haig. He did 45 Years with Charlotte Rampling last year. That's not an LGBTQ story, but if you watch that film, you can at least tell that somebody has a different perspective in telling this story of about a woman of a certain age and the relationships that she has to the community around her.
So now what do you predict happens next? It looks like Love, Simon is going to be a commercial success. A couple things. Do we know how it's done in market to market? I'm assuming it did great in New York and LA and other major cities. I'm wondering how it did in the heartland, because the better it does there, the more likely more films will get made. And will they be marketing this movie overseas? Some movies just, you know, you see Tyler Perry films. I think there's so much money that they've left on the table by not trying to build up an audience for like Tyler Perry around the world. Put in the money, release the movies, and eventually you'll get people to start watching them and seeing them, and then they'll be there for the next time around. And I wonder if they're going to do that with this movie, or will they say, no, this isn't going to work in the rest of the world?
I mean, the last time I spoke to the marketing team over at Fox, they had not yet had a plan for the international rollout of Love, Simon. I do think that, you know, when you look at the domestic box office for Love, Simon, after its second weekend this week, it has hit, I think, almost $24 million, which makes it a success. It was $17 million was the budget that it had for it. I hope that they take the film at least to some, you know, particular international markets, because I think it's a story that needs to be told. But hopefully, you know, even if Love, Simon wasn't a commercial success domestically, even if they don't take it internationally, I hope it doesn't, you know, prohibit other films like it to be made. And I hope, I'm thinking of Moonlight as an example, which, you know, Barry Jenkins is not a queer man, but it was, you know, co-written and based off of a play written by a Black queer man, Terrell Alvin McCraney. And we saw what that movie went on to do, both in terms of kind of box office domestically and and abroad, as well as kind of the critical acclaim, you know, taking home the Best Picture Oscar. And so I just hope that we see more of these films and we see more opportunities for LGBTQ people of all backgrounds to be able to be directors and writers and producers, et cetera, of whatever type of story they're interested in telling.
And let's be clear, most of the reaction of Hollywood will be, well, we did that movie. We did that gay teen film. Maybe in 5 years they'll do another one. So because you have a success with one film or one filmmaker, the work is far from done. You know, if you have three films from a Hollywood studios with black characters in the lead, they're like, wow, look what a great job we've done. Meanwhile, you've got 200 other movies that don't include them.
Very much so.
Could we at least say, hey, we've done that movie with the guy in tights with the cape? Because I'd be happy about that, actually.
But those are the ones that bring in the biggest money, the biggest dollars, you know?
I know.
So that's why we'll keep getting those.
I know.
Which is why Black Panther is so important, for having that size of a budget and then having that movie and who knows what spinoffs. I think the female warriors need to have their own spinoff, but that's just me.
No, definitely. I would watch a Dora Milaje spinoff 12 times over, and I'd pay for every single ticket myself.
And it must be so satisfying for you, because it's been a great last few years for queer cinema and black cinema and people of color in general. I mean, this year alone, we had BPM, a marvelous film from France. We had Call Me By Your Name and God's Own Country coming out in 2017. Those are just three of the biggest titles. And there are others. And now early 2018, we've got Love, Simon, proving a commercial hit. It's got to be a really exciting time to cover this beat.
Very much so. And I would also add to that list A Fantastic Woman, the Chilean film that won Best Foreign Film, starring an amazing performance by Daniela Vega, who is a Chilean transgender actress, who I thought deserved a Best Actress nomination for that performance. But I'll leave that alone. It's a great moment to kind of witness the industry actually making good on these conversations that we've been having about inclusion and diversity. I do often tell people, however, that it still is too soon to tell whether or not the industry has actually turned over a new leaf. As we know, you know, it takes film a few years to you know, come up to speed with things. And so I think over the next year or so, we'll really be able to tell what Hollywood's actual response is to, you know, the Oscars so white conversation, to these Me Too and Time's Up conversations regarding equal pay for women on these sets, when it comes to diverse representations, particularly of Latino communities and Asian American communities and Native communities. There's so much disabled communities still don't get the type of representation that they should be able to see themselves reflected on screen. There's so much more to do. I just hope the industry doesn't get, you know, comfortable and doesn't begin patting themselves on the back just because a couple black people, you know, are getting roles.
No, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And we'll just have to see. It takes a little while for movies to get made. But when they're making money, you can be sure they'll keep making some more movies. You know, there will certainly be a Black Panther 2 and 3.
I hope so. Well, yes, Black Panther, but Black Panther is also, I think, an anomaly in this situation, right? Because what we do know is that black films in particular have always made money. They always get the smaller budgets, mm-hmm. and they always bring back, you know, double, triple, quadruple that. But we see that there still has been a limited number of those movies that are made when compared to all of the other counterparts. We're just now seeing, you know, a Black Panther when we probably should have seen one shortly after Blade, right?
Mm-hmm. I would give Ice Cube a blank check any day of the week. If I was in front of a studio, Ice Cube, absolutely. You know, you're going to make money with Ice Cube every day of the week. So, you know, he should be able to make anything he wants.
Well, definitely on Friday.
Yes.
I couldn't help myself. It was too easy. You set me up.
That was a good one. That was a good one.
Well, hopefully, Travell, as more movies get made, whether they're LGBTQ films or films that deal with race or not, they'll give you even more to write about in the Los Angeles Times and maybe elsewhere. And certainly we will place links to your pieces in our show notes. And where can we find you online? Do you have a Twitter account we should be plugging here?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Travell Anderson. That's T-R-E-V-E-L-L Anderson. And I'm on Instagram at R-A-Y-Z-H-O-N.
R-A-Y-Z-H-O-N. Okay, perfect. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and going over the pieces that you wrote and queer films and the marketing of them and the making of them.
Thank y'all so much for having me once again.
Well, that was great of Trevelle Anderson to stop by again and visit the show. I think if they release Love, Simon in France, I've got a great ad campaign already. Dear Paris, I always knew I'd like gay Paris. Love, Simon.
You, my friend, should be a copywriter.
I'm glad I'm not a firefighter, though, because that is a dangerous job. And we had some unhappy, not an accident on a film set caused by, you know, film set stuff, but an accident and death related to movie making.
What is that? Is this the firefighter Michael R. Davidson who died on the set of Edward Norton, of an Edward Norton directed film?
That's right. They're making Motherless Brooklyn here in New York City based on the Jonathan Lethem novel. It's been a long time of mourning. There was a fire on the set. Firemen were called in, and sadly, one of the firemen died. So it's a tragic news. They've shut down for a week on filming. They're going to figure out what to do next with their damaged sets. But of course, everybody's first thoughts are with the firemen. They don't know how it started or what happened. I don't know if there's any problems with the film and how it was done, but it's, of course, a tragedy. And, you know, people, if they die going to a drugstore or a film set, doesn't matter. It's just a sad day. It's also a notable day that the death of H. Wayne Huizenga, how do you say his name?
Huizenga.
Huizenga. Who is he?
Well, he is the owner of teams. I think he owned the Florida Marlins and the Miami Dolphins, but we probably know him as the head of Blockbuster Video. He bought into, well, first off, he started his career in waste management, in garbage, basically.
He did with garbage, and he said, hey, I know garbage. I can deal with old Hollywood films on VHS. I know that perfectly.
So what he did in his life is he took all of these garbage companies, and he kind of like rolled them all up into a national, you know, garbage collection company. And then he saw all of these video stores, and they were all individual video stores in the 1980s, and he kind of gathered them all up and turned them into the Blockbuster video chain.
Yeah, he made them family friendly. Most video stores were sort of seedy. They always had an adult porn section because that's where money was to be made. That was the first early adopters of VHS machines and VHS tapes. So people with VCRs, they wanted porn. That's just where the money was. So you'd go there, there'd be a porn section, there'd be some Hollywood movies, but it wasn't really the sell-through staple and the rental staple that it became. But he made Blockbuster family-friendly, clean, nice, well-lighted, and it took off from there. And obviously that had a huge impact on Hollywood for many years. We've moved beyond that chain now, though the Redbox is sort of the heir apparent in the sense of the Blockbuster chain. Now you've just got these, you know, machines outside a bunch of drugstores and Walmarts. So, you know, that era came and went. But he has a big, big player in Hollywood.
And a big player in Venezuela is El Sistema, Jose Abreu. He founded El Sistema, which is the youth orchestra where, talent like Gustavo Dudamel, who is the musical director and conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, came out of. He passed away at the age of 78 in Venezuela.
Oh, wow. I did not even know that until you mentioned that now. Oh, that's sad. He's 78, so I guess I don't know what he died of, but very sad.
Well, and you know, here you are learning things on our show. Hopefully our listeners learned something from this week's show. And if you'd like, you can learn something every week from our show, but you don't want to miss an episode.
But not next week.
Not next week. Keep in mind, not next week. But you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find us. And if you can, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We love hearing your feedback. And speaking of hearing your feedback, you can even leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, as well as ways to subscribe to us, and please do rate and review the show in all of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, as well as links to Trevelle Anderson's work. I'd like to thank Trevelle for joining us to discuss queer films and the marketing of queer films. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have a new album out. They also have a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's where the heck was Simon when I was in high school.com.
Well, and if you're having some trouble finding, some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where a lot of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice. Now I gotta cut loose.